the title that I offered for tonight's exploration was The Role of the Body in the Subtle Structure of Mindfulness Teachings. That's a mouthful, isn't it? The Role of Body in the Structure of Mindfulness Teachings. In my experience, and this entire weekend, the teaching of the first foundation of mindfulness, awareness of the body and the body, is going to be from my experience. I will be quoting the Buddha extensively, but I am really reporting from my experience within my own practice, and then the experience that's been reported to me by so many different yogis over a large number of years. So this is not someone else's experience. It's coming from my own experiences, personal. What the Buddha says in the teachings about mindfulness is awareness of each of the satipatthanas, each of the bodies, each of the mind states, so forth, internally and externally. So this is my report of internal and external experiences. But just as the first noble truth is a truth that we often skip over, it's my experience that more sense of well-being, more sense of movement on the path will occur if we spend more time contemplating the first noble truth that there is dukkha and really understanding what that is, because we disguise the vedana, the feeling of pleasant or unpleasant, and our stories about it as though that means that we're knowing dukkha. But dukkha is more subtle than that. And so we need, it's incumbent on us, it's fruitful to spend more time on the first noble truth than jumping to the second and third, fourth noble truth, as we have a tendency to do. So in the same way, there are four satipatthanas, there are four foundations of mindfulness, four baskets, four areas of contemplation, all these different interpretations of what satipatthana means. But these four means, four methods, four manners for contemplating awareness of all of our experience. These four satipatthanas, sati, this mindfulness, patthanas, this method, this way, this seeing through, this having this mindfulness. So that the first of these is mindfulness of the body. And again, there's all these different ways of doing that. The second one is mindfulness of the feeling states, that what's feeling, not emotions as such, but pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor pleasant. I don't mind the child at all, so you don't have to leave. You can, if there's a huge wailing, we can have to work with that maybe. But no, that's even little babies like to hear the Dhamma. So the second satipatthana, that's called vedana, this awareness of pleasant and unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So this feeling tone that comes with every moment's experience. The third satipatthana, the third area for contemplating our experience mindfully, is the consciousness itself of around the various mind states that arise. That's the mind states where they're not very wholesome mind states, and then very wholesome mind states that arise, all of which arise and pass just like everything else. So in the aggregate world, and that's the third satipatthana, these mind states. And then the fourth area of contemplation is the dhammas, or the dharmas, this contemplation of our experiences from the point of view of seeing them as teachings, as learning, as basic principles that empower us towards freedom. And this involves seeing the hindrances of mind, the difficulties of mind, seeing the sensations, seeing the awakening factors, that the factors of mind that lead us to feeling better about ourselves, feeling more able to respond in such a way that we don't cause suffering to ourselves and another. And then the ultimate of the dhammas is that of the Four Noble Truths. So that's the final area of contemplation and looking at these four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness, as a developmental sequence, the Four Noble Truths would be the ultimate, and the awakening factors, the penultimate of this whole path of utilizing mindfulness in order to understand what is suffering and not suffering, and how we can choose one versus the other. Of that whole sequencing, what I would suggest is that it is the mindfulness of the body, really this deep understanding of it, having choice, being able to direct attention, this attention, the spotlight, the manasikaro, learning this skill in a very deep way, I mean, really where we can all be somewhat masterful around this, that if we just learn this as a community, as a sangha, that if the whole average of mindfulness of the body were to rise, that more than any thing, just like with the dukkha, of anything within the four satipatthanas, that would do more to lead our whole sanghas forward in this way. Why do I say this? I say it because everything starts with this body awareness. The Buddha started with it. The Buddha, when he actually had his reflection that led him to his night of enlightenment, was when he thought about himself as a young boy sitting under a tree, sitting on the applewood tree. And he remembered how relaxed in his body he was, and then how relaxed in his mind he was. And he remembered that sense of well-being that came. That was an embodied experience that the Buddha was remembering. And that's what led him to say, oh, there may be another way. There may be a middle way here. He had practiced this extreme asceticism. And he knew that pleasure, because he had had a very pleasure-based life in the family of origin as a young princeling. And that had not brought a kind of security from the woes of the world, and nor had asceticism. And this memory inspired to him, oh, there might be this other way of holding our experience, of being mindful of our experience in a way that did lead to liberation, both temporary liberation and then a full liberation. And so he changed the way he practiced. And then when he taught this awareness, it was this contemplation of the body as a way of beginning with this awareness of the body in the body. Just to demonstrate this emphasis, this is from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses of the Buddha. He says, if the body is not mastered through meditation, the mind cannot be mastered. If the body is mastered, mind is mastered. See, we tend to think of it the other way. Oh, if I master my mind, then I won't be disturbed by body pain or body desire or body despair, whatever it may be. Now, I just get my mind right. It's a good strategy if it works. But maybe, just maybe, it starts the other way. That there's a way to be embodied awareness that allows the mind moments to be known without being grasped onto and without staying holding on to them. Just maybe. Maybe at least it's a balance for each of us in our practice to jumping ahead to somehow controlling the mind. Just maybe. Why not find out? Why not experiment a little? My teacher is this the Venerable Ajahn Sumedho, and he has this wonderful teaching around letting go and just the importance of letting go rather than trying to figure things out, to just let go, just let go, just let go. And every time I hear it or teach it, it brings such joy to my heart. But then it's fair to ask, okay, if I let go of something, what do I let go into? If I let go of this object, my aching knee, my broken heart, my uncertainty about a situation at work, what do I let go into? Okay, I let go of that, but let go to where? Where am I standing at that moment? Where do I stand to let go? Do you understand what I mean by that? Where do I stand? What do I do with my mind? Because there's a lot of stimulation about that situation at work. There's a lot of stimulation about this test that I've undergone for my health. I'm really stimulated by that. So where does my mind go? Where does it let go into? In our ordinary life, what we do is we employ distraction. So we'll use another high-stimulant area to get us away from this high stimulation. We'll get another high stimulation. I see some of you recognize that strategy, so maybe you're pretty good at it even. I certainly was for a period of time. So that's one thing we can do. Another strategy that I certainly employed a lot was tasking. Create some task that I focused on, particularly if there was some high pressure around that task. So that really gave me something to do. It's, oh, I got to go do this thing. I really focus on it. So whatever is the disturbance that I'm letting go of, I've got somewhere to fill my attention with so that it will stay over here and take care of itself, you see? In our regular practice, we often teach stay with that. And so you're upset about something at work, just watch what your mind does of staying with the work. Excellent strategy. We really employ that a lot on our retreats. But a strategy that is implied in some of these, not all of these strategies and other that we could name, is, no, don't worry about all of that. Just stay embodied. So let your mind go back to the embodied feeling. Thus, whatever it is that's disturbing the mind is known through this embodied awareness. If you're staying with it as a strategy, that you're being mindful of uncertainty at work and my grasping around it, you're staying with it, then you stay with it in an embodied way. Oh, you've the felt sense of worrying about a situation at work or worrying about my health. If what you're doing is moving your attention to letting go. Every time your mind thinks about it, you just let go of it. You just let go of it. You let go into this embodied awareness. You're just here. You're being rather than doing. You're being rather than knowing. Doing, tasking, is a wise resource. Knowing is a wise resource. Again, each of these applied skillfully. But then being itself is a wise resource. And sometimes it's not so clear how to just be. But if we've cultivated this awareness of the body, this embodied awareness, feeling the bones, feeling the soft tissue, feeling the organs, feeling all of these parts of the body, we can just be, we can let go into just being embodied awareness. It becomes a refuge. Just like the breath is taught as a refuge, this is more a global kind of awareness. Just being one, embodied awareness. We are that. We may have to prove to ourselves some hundreds of times that that's our experience, that experience is going on. It may take us a while, but we can come to have great confidence in that. So one of the things that I have found in highly emotional situations, you know, with a member of your family or your significant other or something, that where to take refuge, because you've still got to address this situation. Your child's upset with you, lover's upset with you, your whomever it is, your siblings upset with you, you've got to deal with that problem. But how do you not grab hold? How do you not compound the problem? Where is the refuge while you're dealing with this? Back in embodied awareness. Back in embodied awareness. Am I perfect with that? Certainly not. but I get better because I get the opportunity to practice. So as I said in the middle length discourses, there, if the body is not mastered, the mind cannot be mastered. If the body is mastered, mind is mastered. Then, following that, the Buddha says, there's one thing, monastics, that cultivated and regularly practiced leads to a deep sense of urgency. That leads to a deep sense of urgency. Urgency, this energy, this commitment to practice, this commitment to addressing the human situation. Not urgency like desperation. It's not that kind of urgency. Not urgency like I am drowning, but urgency like this is precious time, and there's only so much of it, and I wish to utilize it. I wish to be the most of my life that I can be. I don't know what's possible, but I wish to be available to see what is possible. That kind of urgency. There's one thing, monastics, I'm changing the monks to monastics because I'm wanting to include everyone. There's one thing, we'll make it even further this time. There's one thing, monastics and lay people, that cultivated and regularly practiced leads to a deep sense of urgency, to the supreme peace. That's this nirvana, this letting go. To mindfulness and clear comprehension, to the attainment of right vision and knowledge, to happiness here and now, to realizing deliverance by wisdom and the fruition of holiness. It is mindfulness of the body. So this choosing to emphasize this awareness of the body is well-grounded in the suttas, well-grounded in the structure of the Satipatthana Sutta. And I make reference, in the earlier part of 2015, I had the great pleasure of teaching with, assisting in my words, the Venerable Anālayo, who wrote this wonderful book, The Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization, in which it's all devoted to just this one sutta. And he's now got a second book that's further perspectives on this one sutta. So there, I recommend reading them in this order, starting with this one. You wouldn't. He would recommend you start with the second. So I've spent a lot of time this year contemplating the Satipatthana Sutta in this way. So, awareness of the body in the body. Changing my order a little. This is from an article in the Feldenkrais Journal. Feldenkrais is a wonderful movement practice that's for integrating the body, and Feldenkrais practitioners, they have a kind of awareness through movement, like a yoga kind of class, although it's not yoga. And then they work, there's individual Feldenkrais workers that would work with you in relation to various kinds of injuries. Many of you would know this work. Some of you may be practitioners. So this person is talking about early development. While the embryo is still in the womb. By day 49, in utero, the fetus begins to move a little left and a little right, more to one side than the other. This bias to one side will be a lifelong feature that eventual human beings organization. So first, this is a little to the left and a little to the right, and there's a inclination in each fetus to move a little more to the right or a little more to the left. This is a point in development when the organism is still nothing more than blood, nerve, and bone. The brain does not yet exist. The brain does not yet exist. In other words, movement precedes the brain. And you might say, movement builds the brain. I would say, see, agreement, agreement. After 10 to 12 weeks in the womb, three more basic movements have been added to the repertoire of this evolving human organism: folding forward, an arching movement, arching, and a twisting movement. All of these movements are organized slightly differently in one direction as opposed to the other, in keeping with the original bias. Long before birth, these movements are highly practiced and familiar. The unborn baby also has a clear sense of gravity. That fundamental question, which way is up? The newborn does not learn how to perform the most basic foundational movement. She learns about these movements that are already part of herself. So this movement is fundamental to life. We know, one more thing in the article. If this side-to-side movement, the very first movement, does not occur at this time, that's around this 49 days, the fetus does not survive. This is how fundamental movement is to life. If it's not moving, it's not alive. This is a basic when I studied my own movement training after leaving the ordinary world, the daily world. It was one of the things I did was study body movement and various ways and healing through body movement. So, movement arguably helps develop the brain. Likewise, a baby needs stimulation, or even after being born, it fails to thrive. This is well known in the medical communities. This movement, the movement of the body, the movement of the mind, the movement of the identification of the baby with this smiling caregiver of the care provider for the baby. This is all movement. And at each of these levels, there is a immediacy to that. It's not a theory. It's not magical. It's setting in some mysterious way, this pattern of development. I would say that this pattern of development continues through the entire development of a person for a lifetime. It does not cease to be there in the body. It develops more and more energetically, actually, in the body. What we become aware of, if we're fortunate, is more and more subtlety of this, and more spaciousness around it, and more direct experience of it. So when I was asking you to notice the bones of the pelvis, rather than pelvis, which is a concept, which is a very useful concept, but nonetheless it's a concept, it's describing a relationship of parts in this moment, space-time, but the actual bones, the feeling of the bones as hard or heavy is immediate experience. So right now, put your left hand out and then just rest the right hand on the forearm of the left and feel the weight of that arm. That's an immediate experience. When we talk about awareness of the body, this is awareness of the body. Let that go. It gets heavy, doesn't it? The body is so sensitive, it adjusts all of that for us. The mind does. The whole organism adjusts. It's so sensitive. So this awareness of the body in the body is that sensitive, it's that direct, it's that immediate. So this first satipatthana is directing our attention that fully, that specifically. It's not the mind knowing the body, but it's the awareness of the body in the body. And for those of you who are attending the weekend, we're going to get at another degree of subtlety about this than we're going to do tonight. We're going to sort of start at this and go further in. In the Satipatthana Sutta, encouragement is to know the Satipatthanas directly, fully, in this way. The body awareness, the changing feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, the Vedana, knowing the mind states, the impermanence of every mind state, and then the seeing the truth of the way things are in the Dhammas. These are to balance out. They each one balances out a particular thing, and I'll talk more about that tomorrow. The Buddha says, monks, if anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, in such a way the way he's instructed, which we'll talk more about in a moment, if anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, one of the two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-returning, let alone 7 years. 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, 7 months, 6 months, half a month. If anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected for her, either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-returning. So it was said with reference to this, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and limitation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. This is what the Blessed One said. The monks, nuns, and lay people were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So these four satipatthanas as a whole represent the direct method as described in this teaching. The four satipatthanas, as said in the commentaries and various places in the suttas, they make up their one essence. They're four ways of one essence. The Buddha described them as like four chariots coming in four different directions to this same end. So they're coming in the same way, they're meeting in the center of this release, this opening out. So four different ways in. And any one of them can bring us to these lower levels of attainment, of being a stream enterer, really making a change in lineage, being someone different, just someone different, or being someone who's going to be returning seven times and no more than seven times into human form. You don't have to believe all of that to know that any one of these contemplations given over fully to can bring about a change in your psychological makeup, in your way of perceiving and valuing experience, such that there is more spaciousness, more ease in your experience with life the way it is, in a way that you'd become a kinder person, a more generous person, a person more at ease with the difficulties of life. One doesn't have to embrace the cosmology teachings to embrace the freedom that the teachings offer. So, we're not proselytizers, so not asking anybody to believe anything, but rather to open to your own experience as to what can bring well-being. In order to do that, it does require we practice, and not just sitting on the cushion practice, although sitting on the cushion practice makes such a huge difference in our ability to deepen. But walking around mindfulness is also vital practice. And some of you may not practice very much. Some of you may be doubtful even about sitting practices being that important to you. I would not want to argue with that. If that's what you feel, then make walking around practice your practice. Make it your main practice. You're going to spend more hours walking around than anything else. This is all the doing of your life, from putting away the dishes to driving the car to being in whatever work life, being with your family of origin, your immediate children, your friends, being whatever your life is, tasking away in your life. Bring this awareness. So what kind of awareness? How do you do that? What is walking around mindfulness? A place that I would say to start is with this awareness of the body and the body. You're aware of the body as you're putting the dish on the shelf. You're aware of the body sitting in front of the television. You're aware of the body sitting at the table, aware of the body picking up the spoon. When you discover you're not aware of the body, you pause for a moment and find your way in to being aware of the body, to the point, not that you're always aware of the body, but that it is almost always available when you choose to direct your attention there. The interstitional time, the in-between times, the in-between spaces, this interstitional word, the interstitional time that you've developed is one alternative to fill that time is awareness of the body. So what do you do when you're not thinking about something? You're just aware of the body. What do you do when you are walking somewhere? You're aware of seeing and all this, but in between this moment of seeing, oh, there's this body. There's this embodied awareness that's seeing, hearing, living about. The sense of being alive that can come from this is so terrific. I often stress body awareness on regular Vipassana retreats, and this is one of the things I hear back over and over again. It's really true. When I'm walking down the hill to the dining hall, if I'm resting back in my body, I'm more alive. I'm more able to see. I'm more able to feel, smell. It's like I'm present for the whole unfolding. More likely to be, not guaranteed, but more likely to be. This is testable for yourself. So no one's asking you to believe this. But the testing requires some degree of commitment, some degree. For some of you, some of the things I'm going to say next, probably some of the things I've already said may be a little, you feel like, well, he's a little ahead of me on this. But what I'm pointing out is basic. You don't have to have read anything, sat any retreats, even been to Sims before. Awareness of the body is something you can get. You fundamentally know it because your body awareness, your body movement was your beginning. It's hardwired in, this awareness of the body. Trauma can numb it. Trauma can also cause us to separate from the body experience. We can also have very imbalanced, unhealthy relationships with awareness of the body. When we get aware of the body, we get tense, either this way or just internally tense because of trauma of various kinds, which could be a general anxiety and no big specific trauma, or a lot of moments of anxiety that created a traumatic field, or some or one or more large events, so that the body does not feel safe to us. Likewise, we can have some sort of fibromyalgia or some other condition that awareness of the body can seem uncomfortable. We can learn to be with parts of the body that are not involved in that pain in a way that allows us to stay with the body. We can also learn to hold the body in a much wider expanse so that the moments of discomfort are arising in a much larger field. And in that larger field, the discomfort is less. And as the our amount of discomfort is the actual amount of discomfort multiplied, as an analogy, multiplied by our mind's negative reaction to it. Thus, we might have 5 degrees of physical pain, but if we hate that physical pain, it's not just 5 degrees more of hating the pain, it's 5 times 5, 25 degrees of discomfort, as an analogy, not a scientific fact. And so, as we learn to be more at ease in the body, then, and to be comfortable with the body, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, there comes this empowerment. This amazing, actually, in some instances, empowerment this way. So we can start just where we are. You do not have to have had a lot of experience. You can start now. You can just be aware. You can, at home, just move your hand and see when you actually feel the hand moving rather than conceptualize the hand moving. Just try it for a moment. Move your hand. Are you conceptualizing the hand moving, or are you feeling the hand moving? Now, put the other hand in as just a little touch point and bounce off of it. That starts to have more of a felt sense, huh? Now just let it be, let the right hand push the left hand a little. Having that touch on the focus of the right hand, does that start to make it more physical? As your arm gets tired, then does it become more sensation and stop? Runners, skiers, all sorts of people, yoga people, can all have a developed sense of body awareness, but not necessarily. A lot of people that can use their body amazingly well don't actually have this embodied sense of awareness of the body. I was so shocked to discover that. I have felt nervous systems, which I was going, nobody's nervous system could be this well-tuned. I mean, that's not fair. It's like, whoa, it's so different than what I would have thought from my own nervous system, because I did a lot of hands-on work for the first few years of exploring all this, and yet discover that person really have any awareness of their body. It's just able to do these things. There's not actually an embodied awareness of it, which really gives you pause. I guess I'm stimulated to say, then my body awareness, this embodied awareness, is a cultivated capacity. You may have a natural development of it, but if not, you can, in a relatively short period of time, start to develop a lot more of it. So then why, and this is where we get to the little more sophisticated teaching of this, why is it that awareness of the body would seem to be, would, from the teachings, would seem to say that we can go to this liberation, to the first stage of liberation, just through this one thing? And the reason we can think this is because there's this one teaching called the Anapanasati Sutta, in which the Buddha only takes the breath, and through this awareness of the breath, you go all the way through all of these realizations, these insights into a liberated mind. So there it is, as a teaching. So how is it that this could work? A number of different teachers have said it different ways. The teacher Goenka in modern times says, well, because it's in the body that you feel the feelings. You feel pleasant or unpleasant in the body. And then the unpleasant or pleasant feelings are associated with these mind moments, you know. So it's a mind moment that's having the pleasant and unpleasant, not the body. It's the mind that's registering that. And then all of that leads you to the nature of mind itself, which is the fourth foundation. So that's the way he would say that. Another way to understand it is that you employ the very same techniques in understanding, in realizing, in practicing, in having insights regarding any of these four foundations of mindfulness. So you do exactly the same techniques. You're just focusing on different areas of your experience. And it's those techniques that bring us to the insights rather than the objects that's being focused on. As the Venerable Nalio says, Satipatthana is not about the objects, but about the knowing. About the knowing. So you're learning knowing. You're having knowing that is insightful about the body, or about the pleasant or unpleasantness that registers in the mind, or about the mind states, whether it's anger, exhilaration, happiness, bliss, all of these different. You're knowing. The knowing is what's important, not those mind states. And likewise about the dhammas, it's the knowing. It's the knowing. And so the knowing, that we're developing the knowing, and equally in all ways. The Buddha at one point says that it's as though a piece of bamboo is cut into four parts to make a bowl. But it's just a piece of bamboo. It's one piece of bamboo, four parts. And again, he makes the analogy of the carriages. So to give you, and again, this can seem a little challenging here at first. So you're not supposed to be understanding all the specifics here, but getting a feel. I see how it works. There is a blueprint. There's an architectural underpinning to the Buddhist teachings that is absolutely brilliant. It's to see that some mind did this 2,600 years ago. So he says in the definition part of what is mindfulness, what is the Satipatthana, what are we actually doing? So what is the contemplation of the Satipatthana, what does that mean? He says the four mental qualities that are involved. One is being diligent. This is this interest. And I'll come back to that either tonight or tomorrow. So one is diligence. A second is clear knowing. That is really knowing what you're awake, so that you kind of know what's happening right here. It's got a kind of discriminative intelligence. There's investigative intelligence. The mind's not just registering, oh, breath. There's a discernment registering of breath that's involved in the Satipatthana in a different way. It gets more subtle what's being discriminated, what's being seen, what's being investigated in this fourth Satipatthana, but it starts right there in the first one and gets to very subtle levels. And that's the second. And then the third is having a mind that's free from desire. I'm sorry, a mind that's mindful. The third one's a mind that's mindful. A mind that's got mindfulness. It's you are pre and present. So you've got this diligence you're clearly seeing, and you're being present right now. Right now. Much harder than it seems to stay present right now. Those of you who are experienced, and many of you from your practices and your quiet experience, and you know how hard it is to stay present in the moment. Mindfulness is this kind of being present in the moment. It's a kind of being present because present with an aim, because it's part of the Eightfold Path. So it's not a random mindfulness. It's mindfulness that's got a direction to it. At least this is the way I understand it. Because otherwise, there's mindfulness that has a material gain in it. If you're more mindful in a situation where there's opportunity running around, then you're going to get more of that opportunity. If you're more mindful than the others, you're going to go, oh, here's an opportunity. Oh, if I say to that person, ooh, that's scary, they'll go along with me because they're a fear type. Oh, if I say, look, if we do this, you know, we can get this, and you're a greed type, you'll go along with me. You're mindful, so you see what's the advantage. That's not the mindfulness of the Buddha. It's material mindfulness. And I say this, I use this example now quite frequently because mindfulness is the end thing, you know. It's the flavor of the decade, I guess. So the mindfulness of the Buddha is towards one end, this being able to choose non-suffering over suffering, as I understand it, as I understand it, in both a little way and way. So it's wonderful to have mindfulness and out in the world, but mindfulness out in the world to choose non-suffering in your daily life. Not to gain more toys in life. So that's mindfulness. And then the fourth of these qualities, this quality of free from desire and discontent. And this quality of being free from desire and discontent is loosely translated as concentration. And concentration often, because of the Buddha emphasized it so much, can be associated with these deep absorptions of concentration. But the mind can also be simply collected and unified moment to moment, and that's concentration. It takes a certain amount of collected and unified mind to be able to be mindfulness. If your mind's not somewhat collected, you get mindful and poof, you're gone. You probably saw this tonight in your practice. So you're being mindful, and then poof, gone. The more the mind becomes collected and unified, the more empowered it is to be mindful. In our walking around moments in our daily life, we can become more and more collected and unified. Some of us are excellent in relation to task collected and unified mindfulness. You're a physician, or you're a school teacher, or you're whatever it may be. And your task-oriented mindfulness is great. But what happens when you finish with the patient or leave that classroom? Do you stay mindful? Can that attention stay collected and unified throughout our lives? That we develop a kind of baseline of collected and unifiedness that empowers the mindfulness. The mindfulness that collected and unified mind. So these four qualities alone start to bring us into an empowerment that leads to really changing who we are. Just employing these four qualities to be aware of the body and the body. These four alone. Likewise, and then I'm going to stop and take comments and questions. Likewise, excuse me. Likewise, in each of the, there's a series of exercises about how to be mindful of the body. And there's a series of exercises about the feeling tone. That's different techniques you use to understand them. And we can go over that later, tomorrow or something. But there's a series of these, and they're well spelled out, easily found. Use those four qualities of mind that I just named. We also then contemplate the body or contemplate feelings in a certain way, and we do each of those in the same way. So for each of these, we note them internally and externally. So whether it's the body or whether it's the mind state, we're noticing it internally and externally. That means noticing it in ourselves and noticing the mind of others. So as I am speaking tonight, in looking at your faces and watching your body language, I'm aware of what's going on with you to some degree, both individually in many instances, and feelings in the room, and feelings in various parts of the room. That's externally contemplating. I'm also aware of my own body and the various things that's happening in my own body, not just, you know, my challenge, the respiratory challenge of the moment, but when I'm moving my hands, the way my feet are on the floor right now, I'm aware of this, the way I'm sitting in the chair, that there's actually, it's soothing as I'm moving my body a little. There's a soothing feeling that's there in the background that I'm aware of. I wasn't trying to be aware of it. I've done this so often that I'm aware of it because it's become de facto. It's just habit. And since we're habit-based creatures, let's choose habits that are empowering, that are helpful to us, because we got enough of those other kind of stuff. So awareness of the internal and external experience. Once we learn to do that, we've got a bigger stage of consciousness, a bigger awareness. Likewise, the second one is arising and passing away, so that we see everybody's sensation arises, has a duration, and a cessation. That is so huge. That is so huge. If there's anything I would wish for everybody in terms of this, is this knowing of arising and passing away. It so breaks the solidity of our story making. If I just had, I'd be so happy. If this just stopped happening, I'd be so happy. For a moment. But that happiness arises and passes. It's not such a successful strategy. You know, if only. So that's the second. And it doesn't matter what the object that's being known. This is the universal truth. It's one of the three basic characteristics that the Buddha taught as being essential to understand about life. The truth of arising and passing. This is a fundamental nature of reality in this realm. And if we miss that, our perceptions, our interpretation of our values, everything gets skewed because we think what's permanent, something's permanent that's not permanent. And we get all askew around that. Our conditioning, our reinforcement that Western psychology knows so well, the way the brain patterning with all of this happens, is all being affected by a perception that's just not true. There's not anything permanent. We're lining up at the wrong door. We're not going to get through that door. It's gone. It doesn't matter what's being contemplated, as long as we're contemplating something in that regard. And likewise, then, the third one is that it's a bare knowledge, and there's continuity of it. So it's bare. It's not all of our conceptual thinking about it. It's bare. It's an immediate knowing. Why? Because the Vipassana insight is a direct intuitive insight. It is not contemplative. It is not inductive or deductive. It's an aha. It's a, oh, I get it. It's way faster than inductive in that way. And then the continuity, you have to stay with something long enough to get that aha moment. If you're constantly moving around and you can't hold the attention on something, it's not established somewhere, you don't get a chance to penetrate it. If you're a tennis player and you can't stay with the feeling of sensation and what you're doing in your body, and you've got a tennis coach, I don't play tennis, but I, a long time ago, played tennis a little. If you can't feel the body, and the person said, oh, you know, you've got to put your hip into it, what hip, where, you know, you have to keep your attention on your hip long enough, or how you're bringing your arm around. If you can't stay present with bringing the arm around, very hard to take improvement, because there's no one home to take the improvement. I could say that with anything we're doing, and that just happened to be an example that came out of nowhere. And then the fourth of these is this idea of not clinging to the experience, that we're more interested in the phenomena of experience than our narrative is. So there you are with the difficult person in your life, your frenemy. if you're there with your frenemy, and if you, so first of all, you're aware of your experience and your frenemy's experience. That's something already, huh? And not your judgment of your frenemy, but your actual, what? Oh, you know, they're really anxious. They always interrupt me because they feel like they're not, don't have enough. They need to tell me theirs. They're overwhelmed if I tell my experience. They've got to interrupt to say their experience. They're just, oh, that's just being aware of the external experience. And you're aware of, you get tight, you get begrudging, you get whatever. That's the internal. They're rising and passing away. You feel this, now you feel this. She's saying this, now she's saying that. It's all passing away. So why do we get so involved in the story? Why am I so outraged over this when it's going to end? Lunch is going to end. Why am I making it so solid? It's really a rising and passing. Or then there is this, there's continuity of this longer. And if you see, oh, this is just emotions happening. And you're, again, you're established in the body for all this. I'm using an example that's a little bit outside the body, but, and then without clinging, so that you're not going, yes, she's always interrupting, and this, that's clinging to what? Clinging to your version of the story. There is a story. Your frenemy does interrupt you. Frenemy doesn't celebrate your happiness or whatever it may be. Your frenemy is competitive with you. There's truth to that. There's a kind of relative truth to that. But if you cling to the story of that, then you can't get larger than it. Then you are that story, do you see? You are that story. And there's no room, there's no space. Thus, this being collected and unified and staying with all of this, practice this way so that we don't get caught in the story. The Buddha was a great phenomenologist, far before any existentialist. He was a great phenomenologist. He understood that the phenomena of the experience was what was important, not our story about it. It's not that story isn't important. Story is very important in all these different ways. I do a whole day long on the skillful use of the story and letting go of the unskillful use. But phenomena is the base. Anger is like this. Hurt feelings is like this with my frenemy. My body getting restless. Oh, my body's getting restless. What's going on? Oh, she's interrupting me again. She's interrupting me again. Oh, I'm getting judgment about this. I'm feeling bad about myself. Something. How do you know that? Because you're interested in the phenomena that's occurring in the body so that you can feel this. Then you see what's going on in the mind, and you feel the emotions, the phenomena, the immediacy of the experience, not jumping to some story. This is this whole process. So as we learn to be with the body, being with the body with our frenemy would be a way to be started with this. We learn, we practice all these techniques, and then we expand them out to all four satipatthanas. You don't have to know the four satipatthanas as a new. Don't try to remember this. Be interested that there is a method, there is a practice. Come back, read, listen to tapes, become part of a community of like-minded people, as the Buddha suggests, to like, I want to meet life this way. I don't want to meet life in terms of gain and loss, pain and pleasure, fame and ill repute, praise and blame. I don't want my whole way of meeting life. Those are all story-based. I don't want it to be just that way. I'll do that. Of course I'm going to do that. But can I do more? Can I have more? Can I have an embodied presence, an embodied awareness that gives a bigger sense of meaning, a more spacious, a more mysterious sense of connection? This is the opportunity that begins with awareness of the body and the body, and it's the beginning of a kind of subtle understanding, rather than just, oh, I'm aware of my breath. But there's a subtle teachings in this very first satipatthana. Questions or comments or disagreements? Yes, please.
Help them, like,
Yes.
Environment.
Yes.
Could you speak more about that?
Yes. So what to do if we or someone we care for or someone that we're in some way working with is very uncomfortable being in their bodies. And this is fairly widespread, and it can be widespread in that there's one aspect of their bodies they don't want to be have anything to do with, don't want to go to that neighborhood, or it could be body in general, both. And you mentioned sound as a way for them to, so sound and in the somatic experiencing, they teach a lot about resourcing. So you can use hearing, you can use visual to get people comfortable using the sense gates and then come more into the body awareness. You can do that. Another way to do this is to have some sort of in for a little while and out way of being aware of the body. Find some neutral air in the body. For many people, and I often employ this, it's the feet, because the feet's so far away from the head and also so far away from the heart. But not everybody. I really learned that in a dramatic way, because someone had actually been tortured through their feet, and boom, not a good selection, not a good suggestion, Philip, redo that. So, but that sort of thing. So just, and again, a little, teaching them to just a little touch or a little soothing in the body and stop, a little soothing and stop. A kind of just, can I bring these hands together? Does this feel okay? To name sensation, and again, in a very neutral way, just little quick ways. So just like right now, each of you, name the sensation you feel in the feet right now to yourself. Is it warm, cool? Is it pressure? Just naming that sensation. Being quite specific as a direct sense of it. Hard, soft, cold, warm. Now to do the same with the hands. That can help bring people in. Naming out loud can help them, so that when you're around someone, finding some sort of play around it, to making sensation a play. And then there's all sorts of trainings now that are very good for that. There's one that most people haven't heard of that I've just blanked on for this moment. Maybe I'll think of it in a moment to recommend. Yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, all of this can help, particularly when it's people, when the teachers have this orientation towards the embodied awareness, felt sense, rather than being able to do something with the energy. Because there's really different orientations in these things. Another question or comment? Yes.
Question. You mentioned that worry there's a skill.
Yes.
I appreciate that balanced look versus you know, the black and white thinking
right.
Sometimes happens. So can you say more about
In Buddhist terms, right view, which is the first of the Eightfold Path that leads you to want to practice, there is a story involved in that. The story is that there is suffering and there's an end to suffering. That's a story. That's an aspiration. I wish to be, my intention is to live in such a way I don't create suffering. That's a kind of story. We don't have context without story. So in all of our lives, we have context. We find our values and hold our values in the form of stories. So that's all very useful in that kind of way. So I'm not someone that says, let go of all story. I don't even know what that would mean. You know, that we're going to cooperate at the red light involves a story. Story is that you're going to stop at the red light, you know, when I can go on green. That's my story. And if you don't buy into that story, we're both in trouble. So there's, I just, I'm, I don't I know what is meant by drop all the story, but it's anyway, I just don't think it's so skillful to say it that way. Unskillful story is, my past is so terrible, it's not fair. That's not a useful story. It probably wasn't fair. That life is fair is a false story. You at any time in your life can become anything is a false story. True. Not the president of the United States, despite some of the candidates who are running now. I did that strictly for fun. I was not really meaning to be mean. So we may have a story about I'm always the one who's picked on in my family. It may be based in some facts that you may be, if one were had some little measuring device, you are picked on more than fact. But that doesn't mean that that's really the story. It may be that you're picked on because you're the most fortunate one, you know? Or you may be picked on because that is you're the one person in the family that can absorb the tension of the family. So you carry, it's called being the scapegoat in the family. You may be scapegoated, but if without you being scapegoated, one of your siblings would have been scapegoated and they couldn't have handled it. So there's you making a very narrow story that justifies this whole, what we call papancha mind and these associations of this and that. And then we cling to this whole apparatus and bring all these stories along behind us. Not so useful. That something that I'm always sad is a story that's not true. You're not always sad, no matter if you're the saddest person in the room, and we have a lot of people compete for that here. But you are not always sad. Even at body pain, you do not have a body pain that is always there in the registered mind, in the conscious mind. There, it's just not true. The mind moves off of it. It is not consciously registering. Unconscious is a whole other matter, because from my view, everything's being registered. But in the conscious mind, that pain is not constantly being registered. And so the solid stories that make things seem solid, that justify clinging, those are unskillful. Stories that lead to causing suffering for you or another is an inappropriate use of story. And the way to get out of that inappropriate use of story is to notice the stimuli that's causing the arising of that story as phenomena rather than a story. And as you see it as phenomena, you back the story of it and see, well, what's true and not true, a story. But if you don't have some way to break the story, we cling to our stories. They're so habitual we don't even notice them as stories anymore. But if we see anger, oh, anger is here. Oh, what's the nature of anger? Oh, yeah, anger's like this. It's got this characteristic, that characteristic. Then we drop back into our story, and it's the whole anger, the justifications, all the stuff that's arisen around the anger it breaks apart. It's not the same way. And maybe the anger goes away, or maybe whole new ways of responding to that anger. So that's kind of a... I want to stop. It's 9 o'clock. I'd like to stop with just a moment's silence. A wishing well-being to the world and to all the individuals in the world. So much heartbreak, so much loss of life, so much physical injury, so much emotional injury, so much trauma that we can offer. And I'm going to ask us to say out loud 4 phrases of the loving kindness that came about when I was a volunteer of mindfulness and yoga teaching in a prison. So I'm going to say a line out loud, and I'm going to ask you to repeat it out loud with a certain degree of strength. And this is a well-wishing towards everybody, including the immediacy of Sangha that's here in this room. So when you say the line, you're offering this well-wishing. There'll be a brief silence in which you're receiving the well-wishing for yourself. And as you feel loving kindness being sent to you, this empowers your ability, not just in this moment, but in your walking around mindfulness, to be offering this loving kindness. May you be safe from internal and external harm.
May you be safe from internal and external harm.
May you have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart.
May you have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart.
May you be physically strong, healthy, and vital.
May you be physically strong, healthy, and vital.
May you experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life, just as it is. May you experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life, just as it is. As we learn to stay more present in this moment by staying present in our body, as we learn to let embodied awareness bring us wisdom and compassion, may this be a benefit in our own lives, be a benefit in the lives of all those we care for, be a benefit in the lives of all those that we encounter directly or indirectly. May all beings everywhere find the path to the end of suffering. Thank you for your kind attention this evening. I really enjoy being here. I now know so many of the faces here. I really feel welcomed and home here. And for those of you who are sitting around near someone who held up their hand as someone new, take a moment, introduce yourself to them. Use this as an opportunity to build Sangha for a few moments. And again, those of you who don't have to rush out, just check in with each other.